This is Ukraine calling.
The aid is coming to Ukraine at the point when Ukraine is almost on the verge of collapse. Imagine if things were different, like in 2022 we're getting all that we got now. Imagine what morale was back then. Most capable fighters still alive, not exhausted or dead in the mid-grinders of Bakhmut against the Wagners. The war would be over already, even without F-16 that take so much time to learn. It's not only about the Budapest Memorandum, because it was just like, it wasn't a strong document. The opposition now wants to come closer to power. They want and they urged Zelensky to create sort of like a government of national unity. If you support Ukraine, you should hate Russia. If you support Russia, you hate America. Ukraine is supported by America. Therefore, you hate also Ukraine.
Good day, everyone. This is Brian Bonner, host of Ukraine Calling. We have a real treat today. We have one of the outstanding Ukraine correspondents covering the war now, then Veronika Melkozerova. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
For those who haven't read Veronika, please do. She has one of the great insights in covering the war because she's one of a small but growing number of Ukrainians who are based here in Kyiv covering the war. There are others, but, and I know because my other job for the Cypher Brief is to round up all the daily news in Ukraine. And I always go to your stories, Nika, because there's always a bit of extra insight that you have and a bit of offbeat. You have, you know, always the flair that you had for the offbeat story. And, you know, more than that, we worked together for 5 years or more at the Kyiv Post when I was the chief editor. And I was so glad I spotted your talent in 2015 and hired you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. We have a big week. I don't know what you make of it. Of course, in the war, we have the awfulness of Poltava. 55 dead at the latest count. And every time, you know, and you've covered so many of these tragedies, every time we think in Ukraine, this is it, you know, the world is going to finally wake up that Vladimir Putin is waging a genocidal war, and then we're going to get everything we want and more aid. But then it fades away and nothing ever really seems to change. Do you think this time it could be different?
No, I don't.
Because you've had the theme before, basically saying that we're a nation that doesn't count. Do you still feel that way in terms of the Western response?
I don't want to sound ungrateful because the Western nations indeed did what was considered impossible. They reacted pretty fast. They consolidated some aid. Yes, it's still coming pretty slowly. Yes, it's still coming not when we need it, the exact time when we need it, not in the exact amount that we need. So I would say that the Western nations, they support us, but Western politicians still have their own strategy on how they, how they manage our war expectations and our war. And I think that for Ukraine, it's the existential war. For Russia, it's also an existential war because it knows that if it loses, it will be dismantled. Its empire. Maybe it will be some new Russia, but at this point, I think Russia understood that this is the key time for its existence too, as for Ukrainian. While West treats it like yet another problem, an eternal conflict that needs to be somehow managed, but there is no long-term strategy rather than we should wait and see, and the aid is coming to the to Ukraine at the point when Ukraine is almost on the verge of collapse, not for Ukraine to be able to win.
And you don't think this week will change that?
I don't think
that. In fact, there's some headwinds that we could be running into where people are going the other way. Germany is cutting its budget. We still have the big wild card for the elections. Does it matter who the president is in America?
I think, yeah, it does matter because Americans unfortunately showed not only for not only to Ukraine but also to Europe that it's very hard to count on them. Sorry, Brian.
Yeah. Right.
But they when it was like the last great war in Europe, Americans after that said to all of us, "Hey, disarm and we'll protect you and you can do your what you do will going to be a great policeman of the world," but then they got tired.
We forgot about that Budapest memorandum and the commitments.
It's not only about the Budapest memorandum, because it was just like, it wasn't a strong document, let's be honest here.
And yet that was like what Ukraine got, which wasn't much, as it turned out.
Just like now with all the security agreements, also not much.
And you've covered, okay, let's hope it changes. They're meeting in Ramstein as we record this program and not expecting great revelations. And I also tend to agree with you that it's not going to, this incident, it's just, you know, in fact, I spent 2 days going over your stories for Politico, for the Keep Post, for other people. Because you've worked a lot of places, NBC News, for instance, and you've covered a lot of these tragedies, and we don't see a fundamental change in the West's response. So today, President Volodymyr Zelensky is in Germany, and hopefully he's going to press the case more successfully. That's one aspect of the big news. The other big news was the big shakeup in Ukrainian government. And how many shakeups have we seen in our years as a journalist? It just seems like I remember the average lifespan of a minister is like a year or so in Ukraine. And so there's a revolving door. Now, already the coverage, interested in your insights, already the coverage ranges from this is routine, planned in many cases, we need a new energy, that's the Zelensky-friendly version, to the other side, this is a governing crisis, and we are talking about removing people like Dmytro Kuleba's foreign minister, the head of Ukraine, go for no reason other than Andriy Yermak wanted to consolidate his power as chief of staff for Zelensky. What are you finding out?
That the second one is more close, it's closer to truth. Unfortunately, Zelensky's party victory in 2019 gave him a lot of powers in legal way. He got the mono majority, so he got all the rights to appoint whoever he wants. And then martial law gave him even more powers during war. However, I would say that he uses it to consolidate, concentrate all the powers in the president's office, which many say is not right, because this gives too many powers to a very small group of people.
Yeah.
It's not very democratic and European Union aspirational, as we declare.
Well, we're in a strange situation where, rightly, we can't hold elections, because for many reasons, Russian propaganda, security alone, the fact that 20% of our territory, of Ukraine's territory, is under Russian control. So Ukrainians can't vote out Zelensky and the parliament. They're stuck with them, it looks like, until the end of the war. But those in governance can throw out anybody that they want in terms of their appointments. So there is a bubbling discontent among the opposition, how, or people who actually just have a different view of the way the country should be governed. I don't want to call them opposition necessarily, but how do you think that opposition is going to play out? Because there's really nothing they can do about it, right, until the end of the war.
I talked to one of the top opposition figures, Ivana Klimpush-Tsintsadze, for my story. And she told me basically that the opposition now wants to come closer to power. They want, and they urged Zelensky to create sort of like a government of national unity, which would allow more of non-Zelensky people who cannot cooperate with him. Because unfortunately, even though we don't have, this is what I don't understand, even though we don't have elections, we as a democracy, we struggle for them. It can be seen around all Ukrainian political spectrum. They fight each other. They cannot deal with Zelensky. Zelensky hates Poroshenko still. Poroshenko's party feels the same towards Zelensky. There is no like feeling like it was in 2022 when they all united like in one fist when Kyiv was under attack. As soon as Russians moved away from Kyiv, Ukrainian political scene returned, even without elections.
I'm worried about that after the war, that is going to fall apart like that too. Does it harm the war effort, do you think?
I think it does, because war is not only war front and the army. It's more of logistics, economy, and the stronger economy wins. And what we have is that we have some managers who are in power now, which are more loyal than professional. Some of them are professionals, and they shine like Fyodorov, like Minister of Strategic, former already Minister of Strategic Industries, Alexander Kamishin.
Yes.
They are also from Zelensky's party. So I wouldn't say that all the Zelensky's government and his team are not professional. They are professional, but still, some of those people, they are mostly valued for their loyalty. That's why what I've heard from many officials I talked to, Dmytro Kuleba was, for example, pushed to file for resignation.
We've talked about, and I agree, that there's basically three positions the West can take, which is isolationist, this is not our war, forget Ukraine, doesn't matter, to the other extreme, which is hawkish, which is, listen, the future of worldwide democracy is at stake, we need to give Ukraine everything it has. And what we have is kind of like this middle of the road, keep Ukraine in the fight, not enough to win, no strategy, really. That's the outside world. Inside, are we doing everything we can, do you think, as a society, to get to fight this war and to win this war? Or is there more that we can do?
I think that Ukrainian society is working to the maximum that it can. Because first days of war, there was more unity. People were making Molotov cocktails. People were sheltering others in their apartments. There seemed to be like these lines to the military commission's offices all over Ukraine. But you also have to understand that this is the semi-capitalist society that didn't want war, that never was raised in this war culture as Russians were, basically militarized from school. They were always like this. They had like, we can do it again slogan coming from the legend that only Russians won the Second World War.
Right.
So it was in their culture. They always were at wars. While Ukrainian society was more like chaotic freedom and democracy. So I would say it would also be wrong to expect from people who have been living in this almost unbearable situation for a modern person to stick to the same kind of stamina that they had during their first year of war.
That's true. It is exhausting. Given the fact, and Ukrainians do have a much different society than Russia, thank God. But given the fact that the enemy is here and the enemy never lives up to their negotiations or their word, and there's nobody to enforce a peace agreement against Russia, Zelensky said at the beginning of the war, we're going to need to become a big Israel. And we're not at this point. We're getting there. With Kamishin and becoming more innovative on defense, and you've covered a lot of drone innovations in your coverage, we're getting there. And we're becoming more economically resilient as the war goes on. But a big Israel would mean that we draft everybody at the age of 18, that everything goes for some kind of military duty, not like going straight to Pokrovsk or the front. Do we need to get there to win this war? And do you think we will get there?
I don't think that we should get there, and I don't think that we will get there. I am not a politician and not a political analyst, so...
But you are a Ukrainian.
I am a Ukrainian, and I think that as a Ukrainian, Ukraine could not... will not be managed to continue this war forever, whatever it takes, and for 50 or so years more,
right,
only on its own. Because, as you said, Israel is smaller. Israel has a huge U.S. backing, even now when it does what it does in Gaza. That's why I don't want us to become...
Big
Israel, because...
yeah, it's politically dangerous for any politician from either party in America to not support Israel in the strongest possible way. Unfortunately, that's not the reality for Ukraine yet.
I just think that at some point, I don't want to like sound as a conspiracist, but I recently had a meeting, a very interesting meeting with a diplomat from an Asian country, who told me that, for example, such countries as China, they look at this war and they don't want it to end because they know that as soon as elections in the United States will be over, and, for example, if Trump wins, U.S. will move all its interest from Europe to Asia. Mm-hmm. And that is what's dangerous to China.
Interesting. Well, I mean, that's not conspiracy. I mean, I think that's geopolitical strategizing. And you made some of these observations. You've covered some big international events. I think one of them was the peace conference in Switzerland.
Yes.
Earlier this year, right? Yeah,
in June. It was in June.
In June. You made some observations that, yes, everybody seems, every nation in China has interests that are definitely not in line with us. Just today, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg told China, knock it off, stop supporting Russia in the war. What were some of your big takeaways from that event? Because that was a huge gathering.
I think it was not a peace summit, actually, but Ukraine's desire to build sort of like another UN, but without Russia. But what was interesting there is that so many countries, they came not because they like support Ukraine, because many countries who came, like Saudi Arabia, for example, and India, they had the representatives. Brazil also sent, but they did not sign any documents in support of Ukraine's peace formula. They used the opportunity to speak in front of so many people. And they said actually a lot of interesting things behind, like in between the lines of their official speeches. For example, Turkey said that this war must be over because it already is going out of Ukraine's borders. It already sort of divides the world on camps, which is basically if you support Ukraine, you should hate Russia. You should be America's fan. If you support Russia, you hate America, and Ukraine is supported by America. Therefore, you hate also Ukraine. So that's why we got this very strange phenomenon where former colonies of the West support our colonizer, basically, just because they're so angry at their own colonizers in the past.
Right.
Although those colonizers already kind of admitted they were wrong. But there's still this sentiment that is there. And when you have like countries like Russia and China giving you money just for you to have it, to build another stadium or the road in Africa, for example,
right,
you kind of feel more attached to Russia. Right. So I would say that at this point, the world is divided and the West is again, like West is sort of, and Ukraine are against Global South, Middle East, and Russia, because Russia is not isolated.
Doesn't it have to be? Don't we have to get that way? Because I can't think of a single positive role that Russia plays in the world. Can you?
Of course I can.
What?
Endless resource of gas and oil.
Well, yes. And that gets us to how they finance the war. And some of that gas and oil goes through our territory, as you've pointed out. In stories, we have the absurd situation. And we have then people in the Western camp, Austria, Hungary, and Slovakia, who don't want to let it go. And are actually, well, pro-Russian. Austria is pro-Ukrainian, but sort of goes in different ways. It's pretty absurd, don't you think?
I just think that as a journalist, we tend to be idealistic. I was actually very naive when I thought that the world is about values. Now with this war going into its fourth year, I think, because it's going to continue after the new year.
You don't see an end?
No. I see that most of the countries are not pro-Ukrainian or pro-Russian. They're pro themselves. And while we are dying here, we think that it is the most important and the most cruel, the cruelest thing you can imagine. For the world is just another headline, and their own pockets, their own so-called green energy programs and more
defense contracts. You've written eloquently for the Kyiv Post and Politico in opinions, the Atlantic, New York Times, and so forth about human lives, and some nations matter more than others, and some lives matter more than others. And you drew the all the way back to 2016. You were talking about Syria and Ukraine, and of course you were there at the beginning of the Kyiv Post, where you watched this slow motion disaster that we're living now, because you covered, and I might say in a very exclusive fashion, you know, the construction of the Kerch Bridge, and the inevitability that followed that was that they were going to choke off the Azov Sea and then move on to Black Sea. You scooped the world on that. I still want that front page back, because June 15th, 2018, we had the headline, Russia takes control of Azov Sea. It was the most read story we had in a long time. I didn't put it on the front page. I had Sentsov on the front page, which could have gone any week. So I should have had that one back. But you had covered this, and you saw this all the way through, pointing out the West was just not up to the task. And maybe we weren't either. And maybe Russia wasn't either, because they didn't go all in. Do you have any, have you analyzed what could have changed? Or is there no point in going back?
I think
to prevent 2022, I mean.
I think there was no point in going back because I recently also thought a lot about the past, and I remembered a very interesting episode when I was in Deutsche Welle in Germany. It was like an internship back in 2015. I saw an anti-nuclear energy protest in Germany. Nuclear energy was presented as this main evil that will create a second Chernobyl, and only gas from Russia could save Germany and could let it build its wonderful and strong economy, which it did, mostly because of cheap Russian resources. So I would say that there was, and Ukraine never had like opinion of itself is a strong state, unfortunately. I even heard that in the UN when we were speaking with the Ukrainian ambassador Kislytsa. Mm-hmm. And he honestly told me that Ukrainian diplomacy was oriented more just on the principle that you can solve any issue you have in Washington or in Moscow. Others didn't matter. So we also did not finance our propaganda. We led Russia to just take over all the narrative.
Airwaves. They even had control of our airwaves until 2021. Yeah. I mean, not control, but they had three propaganda spewing TV stations until Zelensky finally got rid of them, the Medvedchuk. Yeah, and we had people, I remember going back to some articles where they were arguing against sanctions, saying that this is not the way to treat Russia. And, you know, obviously the U.S. response was weak. It was all kind of a nightmare that when you read it, the history, it's easy to see where we were today. I'm just wondering why Russia didn't go in all the way back then when we were kind of on our back, you know, Ukraine in 2014, right after the revolution. Yanukovych had fled. We didn't have a defense. Do you think he was afraid, cautious, or just wasn't ready?
I think he wasn't ready. I think he didn't. He hadn't corrupt Western world to the extent that
needed to be corrupted.
Needed to be that it was after the construction of Nord Streams, for right. example. He also after Crimea, it was like a first try after Crimea when he did it and got almost no repercussions. Like got Nord Stream, got Merkel visiting him. Got like the second restart, like they did after Georgia, after what he did to Georgia and keeps doing. He understood that you can do more, so he started. But he didn't want like because Putin is not like a suicidal maniac. He has a lavish life. He has wife, he has kids.
He wants to stay alive.
Yeah. He wants to stay alive. He doesn't want nuclear war. He doesn't want like people, his people to die or those he consider worthy people, not Ukrainians.
Russians are fine, though, to die. He sends a lot of them to death.
That's like
but not
yet
his
another
people.
Topic.
Yeah, that's another topic.
Not his people. Some Russians are fine to die, and they are fine with that. Cause
then what changed? He thought he could get away with it, basically.
Yeah, he saw Trump praising him, how he used the situation to take Crimea.
You have an extensive archive of Trump coverage, which is really impressive. Worrying, I'll say, as American. I think it's wishful thinking, the line that when Trump gets in, that he will have this conversion that other politicians have had. But I know Ukrainians have to play the bipartisan and definitely don't want to get involved in that. So as an American, I'll leave it. We had banner headline, Why Trump Hates Ukraine. Do you get time to ever step away from the day-to-day? Because you did some great investigations for the Kyiv Post. You were part of the Dying for Truth, looked at violence against journalists in Ukraine, honest history, where you gave really, really insightful coverage of Hungarian and Carpathians and Polish-Ukraine ties, as well as Donbass in the 90s. I think that was our series about Ukraine in the 90s. Where, if you read that you can see why we also are where we are today. I hope you get time to do some of that, but the news is coming too fast and furious for you, I think.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Another of your opinions, I mean, you focus on this, like you try to break down, the portrayals of Ukrainians as, on the one hand, superhuman heroes who are doing the impossible, working 24/7 a day, perfect people, and the other extreme, which is, we don't care about this country. It's just corrupt cesspool anyway. Can you go into that? Do you think you've made inroads in getting people to understand? Because you've written, eloquently about when the power goes off in your trash in the apartment and you have to walk up and down 14 floors, I think it is, to walk your dog. Do you get much feedback when you talk about, hey, we're a nation that's just not perfect, but we're trying and we need help and we're going to get there. We're going to pull through this.
I don't think that I'm that important. I just think that when I still had Twitter, I did have lots of people coming into comments, lots of bots also coming into comments and saying that they understand that they are not perfect and Ukrainians are not perfect, but the fact that the Ukraine is under attack and under such brutal invasion, it means that this is the only clear thing. You have to help those who are attacked by stronger bully. It's the right thing to do, and it was the right thing to do. I recently I checked how the World War II started, and I saw that Brits declared war on Germany almost immediately after they invaded Poland under the pretext of the fact that Poles were Nazis, basically, exactly. How Russia, and they were suppressing the rights of German-speaking population. So Germany joined the war. Here we have the situation when it's sort of like I don't know if you checked, but there was like a Hunger Games movie. It's a dystopian movie for like young adult audience where there is like poor districts and they're fighting each other to death while wealthy Capitoli, it's like the part of this world where all the wealthiest people gather, they live there, they have like all the food. And they need spectacles, and they need to keep those poor districts in shape and obedient. That's why they force them like to fight for death. And the one who only stays, this like tributes or something, he gets all the he gets the victory, he gets the prize,
and gets money. The right history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think it's like the same situation we had now. Western societies told us, like, except some volunteers, Western society told us it's not our war. NATO is the defensive alliance, and we won't step our boots into Ukraine. So you have the situation where a smaller country has to perform to its best. Send all the people to war and run economy somehow with no healthy adult population left, because 7.5 million Ukrainians currently live abroad. 4 million of them are taxpayers. Here we have 10 million pensioners who do not work, and they have to be supported. So actually, you as a Ukrainian, you have to stay not corrupt, you have to work your ass off, you have to work 24/7, you have to go to the army, you have to be patriotic, you don't have to criticize Zelensky, you also have to be grateful to West, because West sent you a lot of money, and it's true, but the West is sending you weapons when it's time for the West, not for you. Imagine if things were different, like in 2022, we're getting all that we got now, when we just had our Kharkiv counteroffensive and took Kherson back. Mm. Imagine what morale was back then, and we had like most of our most capable fighters still alive, not exhausted or dead in the mid-grinders of Bakhmut against the Wagners.
Right.
That no. The war would be over already, even without F-16 that take so much time to learn.
Well, we could have learned them by then, but you're right. The scale of the killing was infinitely smaller between 2014 and 2022. Still horrible. I remember you did an interview with Anatoly Mateos where he said half the soldiers have post-traumatic stress disorder. Or I mean, I just can't imagine what that's like now. You quit X, right? Or Twitter. Or yes. Musk quit you. Why? Because of Elon Musk?
Yes.
You had a following of how many?
250,000 people.
And you walked away from that.
I
walked away too, but I only had 25,000 at the end.
I got so many followers just because it was like fashionable back then to follow a Ukrainian. Let's be honest. It's not that big of a deal.
Well, one of the things, you've worked both local, but you just didn't like the pollution or his ideology.
It just has become, as soon as moderation was out, also he started giving the blue ticks, not for those who earned them, with their reputation, because old Twitter.
You had to pay for it, yeah.
Yeah, used to give the ticks only to those verified users.
I paid for mine, and he still took my account away. And I never got a good answer. I went through 10 stages of hell, and there's no customer service there, I can tell you that. But it's good to be off it. I don't think I know it's a source of information, but it's kind of like drinking dirty water. You know? Yeah. You get water, but you get the dirt that comes with it. You have worked for local publications and international. And you've talked about this. What's easier? Because you talked about, I mean, getting, sometimes local Ukrainian officials don't want to talk to you because you know the real story, yet at the same time, they want your audience, which is much, you know, broader than most Ukrainian publications. Which do you like better?
Of course, I do like better to work for foreign publications.
Because?
Because the standards are higher. I mean, Kyiv Post, I had experience before I joined the Kyiv Post. And that was a revelation, like, because of the standards that the old good Kyiv Post had. Because you had, like, editors fact-checking you once, twice, three times. You had them asking questions. You had them, like, really sometimes even forging you in fire just to be sure that your story is strong, because you take responsibility. Your story has an impact. Well, before, in Ukrainian journalism, I worked mostly in Russian-speaking newsrooms that were, like, doing jinsa, which is basically masked, like a political propaganda of certain party masked as a story. It was like
for money.
For money, yeah. I had one newsroom that had like an author, which did not exist, but it was like every month he published some stories about, for example, how good Medvedchuk was actually, or something like that.
God.
And the Ukrainian journalism, unfortunately, was in a very bad shape when I was a very young journalist. So when I came to Kyiv Post, it was like eye-opening experience.
Well, that's good. That's good to hear. You know, I know we could talk for a long time. Maybe this is a good point to leave it. I'm glad you're at Politico. I wish you strength. I wish Ukraine strength and support to see this war through to victory. I think the readers are lucky to have you, and I'm one of them, so I know that. And thank you for joining me. I know you have a busy day and are filing stories left and right, so I appreciate your time, Nika.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Veronika Alkazarova.
Yes.
It is a big honor to have you and to have worked with you for more than 5 years at the Kyiv Post.
So, thank you so much.
That's it for this edition of Ukraine Calling on Hromadske Radio. We hope to see you again soon. Thanks for joining us.